Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When we look at the sluggish recovery of the U.S. economy, one major reason for the sluggishness has to be the economic situation in Europe. Despite all the hype about China's economy, the Eurozone is and remains the closest economic rival in size to the U.S. economy. And when European economies are contracting, well, the U.S. can hardly expect robust growth. Today, my guest is an economic specialist on European finance, the University of North Carolina economist, Dr. Stanley Black. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this month. He's had a stellar career both in academia and in government. He's been at the University of North Carolina since 1983, also taught at Princeton and at Vanderbilt. His government experiences include service with the President's Council of Economic Advisors, the Federal Reserve Board, and the Department of State. He's been a visiting scholar, a professor at the Institute of International Economics in Stockholm, the University of Siena in Italy, Yale University, the Brookings Institution, the International Monetary Fund, and the Free University in Berlin. From 1994 to 1997, he was the Director of Economic Studies for the American Institute of Contemporary German Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. His work has primarily been on problems pertaining to the behavior of exchange rates, the international use of currencies, and European economic issues. He's our guest today as we talk about the Eurozone crisis on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Black, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
We've been hearing about four Eurozone members that have been in the news for their financial difficulties, their debt, and the monetary woes. Obviously, Greece, where you've had lots of demonstrations and the worry of the world because of their government debt, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland. Can you maybe take those four countries case by case? What is the situation on the ground today for those four economies?
Well, each one is in a little bit different place. As you say, Greece is in the worst shape because I believe it started out in the worst shape and it's gotten more difficult for them. I mean, actually, Greece has already defaulted on its government debt. As you know, there was a write-down, substantial write-down of a large part of their debt that was held by private sector banks in other parts of Europe and elsewhere. And they have been forced into this austerity program by the three lenders. They call them the Troika, which is the IMF, the European Union, and the European Central Bank, who are lending money to them. And the problem, I guess, is that they've been forced to cut wages and benefits and government spending so severely. It's driven up the unemployment rate to a very great extent. And, well, you know that there's a political resistance to that and, as you say, riots in the streets.
And take us back to when Greece entered the Eurozone. I mean, they saw a big bubble of development, of money coming
all
into
of those countries saw a big bubble of development coming in because their interest rates fell sharply from what they had been before they were members of the Eurozone. Before they were in the Eurozone, if you lent money to Greece or Spain or Portugal, you had to worry about the exchange rate of that country depreciating, and so therefore you'd get less money back.
And they've always been inflationary economies.
They have had tended to rely on inflation as a tax to bring money to the government, and they gave that up. And as a result, their interest rates went down to the German level. The people in those countries thought, we can borrow money at an incredibly low interest rate. What a great opportunity to build things.
And in that case, they actually built things that really can't be, you know, housing for the most part.
Housing,
instead of things
construction,
like
they don't produce revenue from abroad.
Yeah, manufacturing or things like that, which has this greater resale value, I guess.
Well, and the key thing is you're borrowing from abroad to do this building. You'd better be able to earn money abroad to pay it back. and you can't do that from apartments and that kind of construction.
And the other part of it was you mentioned that inflation had been sort of part of the economy, and so wages tended to move up.
And they kept moving up
even after you have low interest
rates.
Well,
especially because you've set off a construction boom, and that's not a period when you're going to suddenly change your wage
behavior. Hold the line
on
wage.
Right. And on top of that, the Greeks had an additional thing, which is that you remember the Athens Olympics.
Yes.
Which they spent a ton of money on. And needless to say, that doesn't make them much profit these days.
Okay, so Greece obviously in the worst shape.
And this furthermore, the Greeks apparently fudged the numbers to get into the European currency. They didn't tell the truth about how much they were borrowing. And I think they may have had some help from Goldman Sachs in disguising some of their borrowing, even. So they were not exactly straight with the others.
Now, what about the Iberian Peninsula? That's Spain and Portugal.
Spain and Portugal, they were not a problem of so much of excess government spending, but they also had the construction boom set off by the low interest rates. And it was a situation where they continued to have wage growth faster than prices, and that really raised their costs over time.
Now, was it a matter of like your classic real estate boom in those two countries?
It
because
was.
It reminds me of, you know, Florida in the 1920s.
Yep.
You know, every Brit was right. wanting to buy real estate in Spain and Portugal.
And everybody in Spain and Portugal was thinking, I can sell it to the Brits. And there are only so many Brits who are going to buy, after all. They overbuilt. And there's some other examples of excessive construction. There's a rather famous airport in the coastal area of Spain, which has no flights in or out.
Is that the Costa del Sol?
Yeah, right. They thought there was going to be a big development there, and it was going to require lots of flights in and out for golf courses. Well, the golf courses never got built, the tourists never came, and the airport sits there.
Oh, interesting. And in this case, it was private debt.
Much of the construction was. Of course, the airport would have been public.
Yeah.
Basically a local government area, a local government that built it. But mostly private debt for the construction. And that was financed by the Spanish banks, particularly the Spanish savings banks, Caixas they're called. And
these were like SNLs?
Yeah, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Right. And they lent huge sums on this, which much of which has gone bad. And so they're the ones who have been having to be bailed out and creating the problem for Spain.
And the same for Portugal? Has it been the
similar,
same
similar
story?
Smaller scale, clearly. Smaller country, smaller scale. But, yeah, similar problem.
Now,
and Ireland, too. Ireland had exactly the same construction boom issue. And again, created by the very low interest rates. And you have to think about it. The interest rate that's relevant for a borrower is the difference between the rate he pays and what he's going to earn on what he is building with it. And what he earns is going to be affected by the inflation rate. If he thinks that prices are going to be going up, that makes the profitability of his investment greater. And we measure that by the difference between the interest rate he pays and the inflation rate. We call it the real interest rate. And if the inflation rate's higher than the interest rate you're paying, you're actually getting the money for free, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's what they were getting in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland. They looked like they were getting the money for free because their inflation rates exceeded the interest rates they were having to pay.
But, of course, they're constrained by a joint currency which can't be devalued.
Well, the thing about the monetary policy of the Eurozone is it was aiming at the average inflation rate to be about 2%. And these countries had inflation rates above 2%. Meanwhile, Germany, the central country, in a sense, in Europe, had an inflation rate of practically zero because they were trying to lower their unit labor costs and to try to become more productive, and they succeeded in doing that. But we had an imbalance in Europe between the core countries, Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands, who had this low inflation environment raising their productivity, and the periphery, these countries around the outside, who had the inflationary environment. So it was not a balanced situation at all.
How much is this due to a hangover from the German unification? I mean, that's
quite a bit.
As I understand it, you know, that whole integration of East into West basically created some of the same conditions temporarily that a lot of these peripheral countries had on an ongoing basis, and they felt like, well, you know, our conditions are not much the same. But what Germans did was they became more productive, they held their wage line, and became more productive and
Let's go back to the unification process to start with. In order to tempt the East Germans to vote for unification, the West Germans offered them a real deal. The old East Mark was really only worth about a third as much as the West Mark. But the West Germans said, we'll cash in your East Marks at one for one. So we're going to give you a big capital gain there right off the bat. And so the East Germans thought, that was really good. We'll vote for the Christian Democrats for unification, which they did. And then once they got into this reunification process, the West Germans said, well, we want to worry about the fact that wages are so much lower in East Germany than they are in West Germany. That's going to tempt all these guys to move west. We don't want that. So let's raise wages in East Germany as well. So on the one hand, you jumped up the price level by putting it one for one. And on the second place, you raised the cost level by raising wages. And so suddenly, a lot of East German industry is completely uncompetitive and started closing down. The West Germans have to start shipping 60 billion Deutschmarks a year east to help pay for that, to keep the country, that side of the country, afloat. And their whole cost structure for the unified Germany is now out of whack with their exchange rate. And so when they went into the euro in 1999, their exchange rate was overvalued, we say. The exchange rate was too high for their cost structure. And so they went through a process of slimming down the cost structure over the next 10 years. And they were doing that while these other countries on the outside, on the periphery, were having a boom. They were on the slimming diet.
Yeah. My guest today is Dr. Stanley Black, a professor of economics at the University of North Carolina. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and speaking on the Eurozone crisis. You know, I'm hearing all sorts of stories about how they're trying to fix the situation with these countries that are, the people are resisting the austerity measures, and there's now this new thing called the European Stability Mechanism, which is basically going to be a permanent fund that is, I guess it's a permanent bailout fund in many senses. How's
Something
this going
like
to work?
That. Yeah, well, first thing is we had to realize, what is the purpose of the austerity programs? The purpose of the austerity programs is to lower the costs in these countries, to have them go through what economists would call the gold standard adjustment process, which is if you're in deficit, you've got to lower your wages and prices and costs. Yeah. And that's what they're having to do right now. And it's difficult in countries where they're not used to having that kind of adjustment.
Give us a sense of the austerity programs. Before Greece was in the Eurozone, you know, their wages were much lower. Standard of living was lower, I think. Isn't that the case?
Than Germany, say.
Well, yeah.
Probably, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the southern...
On the other hand, they had been rising over time in Greece and had been relatively generous pensions, relatively cushy arrangements for government workers. The Socialist Party was in power for a long time and tended to pay off its constituents with generous benefits.
Health?
Health was very generous, I think. On
working hours?
Greek standards, retirement was early. Actually, the representatives in the Greek parliament had the opportunity to get two pensions, one from their former job in the private sector and one from the parliament as well.
Wow.
and then they weren't very good at paying taxes either. It's quite famous that the tax collections in Greece are extremely low. People with swimming pools pay taxes on very low incomes, and it's just not credible.
So the austerity measures, is it reducing, I mean,
are reducing pensions, reducing wages, cutting employment, and of course that tends to contract the economy. And when that happens, people lose jobs just like they've lost jobs elsewhere when the economy shrinks. Like in the U.S. that happened when
this vicious cycle, don't you?
You do, and you're trying to bring down your debt to GDP ratio by having less debt. But the problem is you're also getting less GDP. So you may be shrinking the numerator a little bit, but the denominator may be going down even faster. So you're not going to necessarily get too quick a resolution.
So in the wake of that, and that's certainly what Greece seems to be experiencing now.
Not just Greece. Spain, Portugal, Ireland have all been experiencing the same thing. And even France has been following austerity package somewhat. And what you see is in every one of those countries, the government that brought that in has fallen. Government changed in Greece, it changed in Italy, it changed in Spain, it changed in Portugal, it changed in Ireland, it's even changed in France.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't like this.
And you're looking, I know, just overall unemployment in most of those countries, I know maybe in France it's 12%, is that right, or somewhere around there?
Perhaps that's it, I don't know the number.
Yeah.
But it's up to 25% in Spain, and Greece is even worse. So unemployment is serious. And, well, this is a process that they're undergoing to try to squeeze their prices and costs down. And it is happening. The prices and costs are coming down slowly. But the problem is this is an unbalanced situation because the imbalance is within Europe. That is to say, German costs are lower and these countries' costs are higher, so they need to change the balance. Now, the way to do that is partly through lowering the costs in the peripheral countries, but you should also be increasing wages and prices in the center countries. And the Germans are not cooperating in that area. They think they don't need to change their own behavior.
Is this a matter of self-interest in the greater global economy? They figure if they raise, they become less competitive?
They spent 10 years trying to become more competitive.
Uh-huh.
And they don't want to give that up now. They
right.
feel like they've been virtuous, and their virtue should remain rewarded in the same way. And these other fellows have been, slackers.
We took our lumps. Now it's time for you to take your
lumps. Exactly. But the problem with that is you have negative economic shocks in all the peripheral countries and nothing positive coming out of the center. It needs to be more balanced. What you need really for the European situation to resolve itself quicker is for more expansion in Germany and Austria and the Netherlands, the core area, to balance the contraction that's occurring in the periphery so that the whole of Europe is not thrown into recession. You need some strength coming from the center.
What are some steps those central countries could take?
Well, they could take some fiscal steps, some tax cuts and expenditure increases that would strengthen economic activity there and lead to more imports from the peripheral countries.
So Keynesian economics?
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes.
Yeah.
Now, the Germans don't like that. They say, no, that's not the way you do it. You just have to go into the sweat box and sweat it out, and you'll come out feeling better at the end. But those people in those peripheral countries, they don't feel very good about that.
And, of course, this has been the arguments that have been going on the last couple of years, asking Germany to provide stimulus.
Well, actually, those arguments have been mostly coming from the U.S., not
right.
so much from within Europe, because the Europeans are unwilling to challenge the Germans very strongly on this. Some of them have asked for it. I mean, the French, mm-hmm. for example, but the Germans are pretty resistant.
And why have the periphery countries not asked for? Is it just a matter of a lot of German banks and German interests own some of their debt, or what exactly?
Well, they are in a position of being supplicants, really.
Yeah.
And they need the Germans to continue to support the bailouts that they've been getting. And they know the Germans are resistant to this argument that I've been putting forth. Not all Germans, by the way, the German government. So there are German economists who are saying the same thing that I'm saying, as well as other economists in Europe. But I think the people in the periphery, the governments in the periphery, are reluctant to push too hard on the Germans because they need their goodwill.
My guest today is Dr. Stanley Black, a professor of economics at the University of North Carolina. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the Eurozone crisis, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you've written about is advocating varying interest rates for member states of the Eurozone from their central banks to their private banks as a way of easing this. Can you explain how that would work?
Well,
I'm simplifying it, I'm sure, way too much.
No, that's okay. I was going back to the fact that in the early part of the Federal Reserve System era in the United States, when we had regional differences that were very marked. For example, California was growing very rapidly in the early 20th century.
Oklahoma, so much. We were very depressed.
Right.
And Northeast, very powerful industrial
right.
area.
So differences, the regional differences. And the Federal Reserve compensated for that by allowing regional differences in interest rates to occur. And that was because, well, the U.S. Financial sector was still not fully integrated. It was still on a regional basis. So you needed regional differences. Well, looking at Europe, you could say that Europe is not fully regionally integrated either. It needs some kind of differences. I think perhaps in today's economy, my suggestion is probably not the best idea. In fact, but a similar point has been made by Paul de Grau, who said, well, it may be not different interest rates, but what you could do is have different reserve requirements on the banks in the different regions. So the regions which are inflating too fast, you could have higher reserve requirements on the banks there that would tamp down that inflation difference. And the ones which are have below average inflation, you could ease the reserve requirements. So you can make the reserve requirements on the banks differ, and that would have the same effect as actually having different nominal interest rates because it would mean that the bank's profit ratios would be determined by those reserve ratios.
Now, would capital tend to flow to the higher interest countries?
Well,
except with, you know,
if you use the reserve requirement, it's going to tend to limit the attractiveness of capital flowing to those areas. What happened during the era that laid the seeds for today's problem is that capital did flow excessively to these higher inflation countries.
They just saw the high rate of return, right?
They saw, well, the people who were there saw a really low interest rate, and they wanted to borrow the money. And the banks couldn't lend the money at home because there wasn't so much demand for it. So they sent the money to those countries. But if the reserve requirement was higher, they wouldn't be able to get such cheap credit so easily. It would be harder for them to get the cheap credit in the peripheral countries, and that would tend to limit this divergence. The real problem, I think, is that the ECB, which is responsible for overall monetary policy in Europe, allowed these inflation differences to go on for 10 years, only worrying about the average inflation rate, and they failed to take account of the regional differences.
Hmm. Is there any sense that the European Central Bank is going to really change, you know, some sort of structure where you sort of have this sort of national, a much stronger national, transnational presence, I guess, in the case of the European Central Bank?
They're going to need to take a stronger line in interfering with the economies of the member countries so that the economies produce more uniform inflation rate across Europe. But that will only be the case after they've gone through this adjustment process. So right now we need higher inflation in the center countries and lower inflation in the peripheral countries. And the monetary authority is not in such a hot position to do that except through things like reserve requirements. Mm-hmm. It's really the fiscal authorities who have the opportunity to make these changes. So it's the austerity in the peripheral countries, and it should be matched by some anti-austerity in the central countries. And that would be the proper way to try to get through this adjustment process. Once they get through it, then they can worry about trying to keep more uniform inflation.
You know, one of the things I've read as this crisis is unfolded is some are writing for greater integration between all these economies. Then there are others who are saying maybe this is just a bad idea, that we can't bridge our differences as peoples to do that sort of integration that's needed. What is your thoughts on that?
It is a little bit late to say it's a bad idea. It was a bad idea the way it was started, but they've done it now, and it's going to be very, very hard and very painful to undo it. It's not easy to unscramble this omelet, and there was a recent estimate, actually, what will be the cost if first Greece pulls out of the euro, then perhaps Spain pulls out of the euro, then Portugal, possibly Italy. What would be the cost? This German Institute just recently came out with an estimate of 22 trillion euros for the cost of something like that. So it's not something you want to contemplate, really. What they've got to do is get through this adjustment process in a way that doesn't lead to political collapse in Europe. And that's going to require, as Angela Merkel has said, more integration, more Europe, not less. And they're trying in various ways to create the fiscal centralization which they needed and never had. You see, in the United States, if there's regional differences in the way the economies are working, the federal government redistributes money automatically through differences in what happens to tax collections, through difference in what happens to unemployment compensation and other kinds of benefits. That's automatically reshuffled in our economy through the federal government, which spends about 20% of GDP. Well, the central government in Europe only spends 1% of GDP, so they don't have any way to redistribute among those different countries, and they need to create some way. That's the kind of centralization fiscally that they need.
Now, when you look at a country like the UK, which is nominally a member of the European Union, but they're not participating monetarily in any shape or form, does that leave them looking on the outside of the whole European Union at some point if you have that greater integration?
It does. And they have actually blocked already some efforts at greater integration. So there was a constitutional treaty change that occurred, has now been ratified, which permits greater interference in the fiscal decisions of the member countries. And it was not permitted to be a European Union-wide treaty because the British objected and said, we don't want to have any part of this. So they had to have a kind of a subsidiary treaty among the members of the Eurozone alone. And that is tending to, create divisions within Europe.
Well, be interested to see what happens. Dr. Black, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Stanley Black is an economist at the University of North Carolina and was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Ever want to go back and hear an old Studio Tulsa? You can anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just click on Studio Tulsa and you can listen online anytime. And while you're there, you might make a pledge as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.